I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party candidate for governor in 2010, 2014, and 2018, and I'm going to announce today I'm running again this year. I was also the Green Party candidate for president in 2020, and this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to advance, educate, and organize around the eco-socialist platform that Angela Walker and I ran on. So here we are. The war in Ukraine goes on. And I want to say a few words about, you know, the kind of demands we should be raising. There's a was an online rally. I think it's probably over by now. It started at noon. That was sponsored by CoPink, Peace Action, Stop the War Coalition in the UK, and a large number of mainstream peace groups. And they have a lot of prominent speakers, Vijay Prashad, Noam Chomsky, Yanis Varoufakis, Tariq Ali, Medea Benjamin. And their demands were ceasefire in Ukraine and settlement now, Russian troops out, and no to NATO expansion. And I think those are pretty good demands. My comment would be that a ceasefire and negotiations are going to require that the Ukrainians halt the Russian invasion so that the Russians will actually negotiate. The Ukrainians, Zelensky, have said we're willing to become a neutral country if we can get security guarantees from the big states. And they're ready to negotiate the status of the Donbass and Crimea. But in order to get a stalemate, a ceasefire, or, you know, basically a stalemate on the ground militarily, they need arms, which this demonstration did not call for. I've also commented on the no to NATO expansion demand. I've found, you know, in demonstrations we've had, that the public, even people that show up for the demonstrations, kind of curious, so what do you mean by that? Because aren't we here to stop the Russian invasion? And I think it can be better put forward as a positive demand instead of a negative demand. And that would be US-NATO diplomatic initiatives toward a pan-European security framework that includes Russia, which would be post-NATO. And then those negotiations should go toward mutual, conventional, and nuclear disarmament. Because if anything this war has brought up, it's the nuclear issue, which people seem to have forgotten since we had those arms agreements between Reagan and Gorbachev around 1990. There's another statement coming out this week that I like a little better. It's an international left statement. It should come out, you know, early in the week. It was initiated by Ukrainian and Russian Democratic Socialist parties, the social movement in Ukraine, and the Russian socialist movement. And their demands are immediate and unconditional withdrawal of Russian troops from Ukraine, support for the Ukrainian resistance, and this is what's different, its right to get weapons it needs for its defense from whatever source available. And I think for the left, that's key, because we support the right of self-defense and national self-determination. And if we don't support the Ukrainians getting arms, we're not serious about those two rights, to self-defense and national self-determination. Third demand is support for the Russian anti-war movement. I think that's crucial, particularly if it can get the soldiers, you know, Russian soldiers, to begin resisting participating in the war, which was a big factor in why the U.S. finally got out of Vietnam. Our soldiers, particularly after the Tet Offensive in January 1968, they refused to fight. The army basically disintegrated. That's key. They have a demand Russia should be forced to pay reparations for what it has inflicted on Ukraine. I actually question that demand because makes me think of the Treaty of Versailles that ended World War I, and the Germans were punished with harsh reparations, and that led to Hitler and World War II. So I'm not sure that's the best way to do it. Russia, which is going to suffer from the sanctions, is going to need reconstruction assistance. Of course, Ukraine will as well. Next demand is no to any increases in military expenditure. And they mean that across the board. And it says, we pledge to launch, as soon as this war ends, a new campaign for global disarmament, the dissolution of all imperialist military alliances, and an alternative architecture for international security based on the rule of law, which is basically what I was saying is a better way of framing the no to NATO demand. And their last demand is open doors in all countries to all refugees fleeing wars in any part of the world, which is important because the Ukrainians have been pretty well received by Europe, not so much the Syrians and the Libyans and the Afghans and other people fleeing other wars. And that's a problem. So I would have liked to see added to these list of demands, and I'm actually surprised it wasn't, because it's a demand of the social movement in Ukraine, is that Ukrainians' debts to the International Monetary Fund and foreign banks and hedge funds be canceled. They need that money now for medical and housing services and for reconstruction when the war is over. And I think Ukraine just paid a $2 billion payment on that foreign debt. It's over $125 billion. So I think that's the demand we should be talking about. But I think the international left statement, and look for it this week, is a better approach because it supports what the Ukrainian people, and particularly the left in Ukraine and Russia, are demanding. And, you know, the Code Pink demands really don't express solidarity with the people suffering from Russian aggression or with the left and peace movements in Ukraine and Russia and what they're demanding. You know, the pacifist demand of no arms to the Ukrainians is really basically saying, you know, Ukraine should submit to the Russian invasion. And that won't lead to real negotiations, which require that their military be halted. So they do take up these offers from Ukraine for neutrality and, you know, a decent, fair process for the status of the Donbas and Ukraine. So, you know, that's why I think one of the things we should be supporting is arms for the Ukrainians. So this war goes on. It's moving. The Russians have left the northern areas around Kyiv and are now focused on the east and the south in what the analysts say is going to be more like a World War II, you know, mass formations, lots of tanks and armor. It's going to be bloody. And, you know, what we need as soon as possible is, you know, for that to get stuck and then negotiations to get serious, because the longer this war drags on, the more it's going to ruin Ukraine, which has already suffered a lot in terms of, you know, cities being bombed and people being killed. So while this has been going on, 2 days after the International Panel on Climate Change's sixth assessment report came out, and it told the world that greenhouse gas emissions had to peak by 2025. That's about 1,000 days from now. It has to do that if the world is going to have a 50-50 chance of staying below 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature rise, which is really the threshold. It's a threshold for really serious climate problems, but it's really we're already facing them, and they're going to get worse. And a lot of this is built into the planetary system as it is. 1.5 degrees was chosen back in the Paris agreement in as a compromise, because the bigger powers wanted to say 2 degrees, because it was still possible. And it still is possible, but we've got to move quickly. And while this comes out 2 days after that assessment report comes out, the Democrats on the House Energy and Commerce Commission committee were demanding that big oil CEOs, who they had before them, produce more oil in response to rising oil prices. Nothing about getting off oil. And, you know, let's remember the House Energy and Commerce Committee is where Pelosi wants the energy and climate issue addressed. And definitely not the special Green New Deal Committee that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez joined the Sunrise Movement in demanding after the 2018 election in that famous sit-in in Pelosi's office. So Pelosi rejected that. So AOC and Senator Markey came up with their non-binding Green New Deal resolution to get a sense of the Congress. And it was a real step back from what the Green Party have been demanding as our signature issue for the last decade. It dropped the ban on fracking and new fossil fuel infrastructure, which is the leading issue right now. The U.S. is proposing and helping to finance and urging its companies to set up more liquid nitrogen gas, to degasify the LNG, which is low temperature when it gets to Europe, and basically substitute U.S. frack gas for the Russian gas, which is not what the climate needs. So that ban on fracking and new fossil fuel infrastructure is essential, and it wasn't in this non-binding resolution. They also dropped the phase out of nuclear power. They dropped the deep cuts in military spending to help pay for the Green New Deal. And they changed the goal for zero greenhouse emissions from zero emissions to net zero, which means continuing to burn fossil fuels with so-called carbon capture and sequestration, which unfortunately the sixth assessment report of the International Panel on Climate Change put a lot of emphasis on. And that's because to get that approved, it has to be approved by all the, it has to be a consensus document of all the members of the United Nations, which includes petrostates like Saudi Arabia, Russia, and the United States. So instead of pushing harder for cuts in greenhouse emissions sooner, they put in this idea that we're going to ramp up carbon capture and sequestration, which just hasn't worked. I mean, most of the projects with enormous government subsidies have not worked. So it's a technology that's not there and has a lot of problems. I won't go into all of them. And then, of course, they extended the deadline for zero or net zero emissions by 20 years, from 2030 to 2050. And then Pelosi never let him vote on it in the House. When it came to the Senate, McConnell had him vote on it to get the Democratic senators on the record, and none of the senators voted for the non-binding resolution. They abstained. And four of them voted with the Republicans, no. So that's where the Democrats are at. And also remember that this House Energy and Commerce Committee, AOC asked to get on it after the 2020 election because it deals with the Green New Deal. And the Democratic leadership instead rallied behind the conservative Democrat, Kathleen Rice, who beat AOC 46-13 on a vote on the Democrats' leadership body in the House, the Steering and Policy Committee. So the Dems seem to have forgotten about the Build Back Better climate program and are now begging big oil to produce more oil. And oil production, since Biden got in office, has increased by more than 2 million barrels per day. And Biden has approved more oil and gas drilling on public lands per month than Trump did. So in the last year, we saw U.S. carbon emissions were up 5% and global emissions up 6%. We're going in the wrong directions. So, you know, that's why we need to have Greens out there running, and we need to be advancing our own program, because the Democrats just aren't doing it. I mean, they are now calling for more oil production instead of pushing for the reduction in oil and other fossil fuels. So that's one of the reasons I'm running. I was nominated for governor of New York. I was nominated last Sunday by the New York Green Party State Committee. My running mate will be Gloria Matera, who's a co-chair of the Green Party in New York, was for a number of years a co-chair of the National Green Party. She was my running mate when we first recovered our ballot line in 2010 and kept it for a decade. She's tentatively agreed to come on this podcast in 2 weeks on April 23rd. So that should work out if she can confirm her schedule. So we face an enormous job. We have to get 45,000 signatures in 42 days. That's the most difficult ballot access petition statewide in the nation. And we have to remember the United States is the most difficult nation to get on a damn ballot in the world. You can't compare governor in most countries because they're parliamentary systems where the executive comes out of the majority coalition in the legislature. But we can compare what it takes to get run as an independent for national legislatures. In New York, it takes 3,500 signatures. And that's about average for states. But some states, it's much worse. It's over 15,000 in Illinois, over 20,000 in Georgia, over 30,000 in Alabama, over 40,000 in Indiana. And people wonder why there are more third-party candidates running for the House. Compare that to other countries. You want to run as an independent for the House of Commons in the United Kingdom? 10 signatures. You want to run as an independent for the unicameral parliament in New Zealand? 2 signatures. It's 100 signatures in Canada and Australia. It's 200 in Germany. But in the United States, it's thousands or tens of thousands. In fact, looking around the world, I've been doing the research on this. The only place I can find is comparable to the United States is Putin's Russia. You want to run for the Duma from an oblast, which is like their state, states. It takes 15,000 signatures in 45 days, 3 more days than we've got in New York this year. And we've been shopping a fair ballot access bill around the New York legislature. No Democrats have yet decided to write it up and introduce it. But in our Zoom calls with their staff, I've been joking that we just want to get New York's ballot access standard back to the Putin standard. You know, maybe in the future we can talk about a more reasonable standard, but that would get us back to 15,000 instead of 45,000 in 42 days. It's even still a little bit more difficult than the Putin standard, which is 45 days. So we face a big job. We need at least $100,000 to help pay for petitioners. We've raised $30,000 so far. So we're serious. Petitioning starts April 19th. It ends May 31st. And if we can get the first three links I put in the private chat, in the public chat, it'll tell you, first of all, where you can sign up to donate to the campaign to help us pay for these petitioners. There's a link for how you can apply for one of the paid petitioning jobs, which we're paying $20 an hour. And we need people to do that. And then the third link will be about how you can volunteer if you're in New York or nearby with the petition drive. And all the help we can get, we'll greatly appreciate. So we have a campaign here in New York where we have a center-right corporate Democrat named Kathy Hochul, who's now the governor. She's raised money as fast, if not faster, than Andrew Cuomo did from the big banks and financial interests and the real estate interests. It's obscene. And the Republican is a Trump-loving extremist named Lee Zeldin, who's in Congress right now and believes in the big lie that Trump won the election. So there's a huge vacuum on the left. And if we can just get on a ballot, which is going to be the hardest part, we're still going to need 150,000 votes or so to secure a ballot line for 2024, which will greatly help whoever the Green candidate is for president in 2024, because it'll just save a lot of money and effort from the ballot access drives that candidate will have to do. So whatever help y'all can provide, we will greatly appreciate it. So this huge vacuum, we're going to fill it, of course, with the Eco-Socialist Green New Deal. We also have a second theme of inclusive democracy. And Eco-Socialist Green New Deal, of course, is a crash program to get to 100% clean energy and zero emissions in 10 years, which is what this climate science is telling us we've got to do in rich countries like the United States and New York. New York has an economy about the size of Russia. It's about the 10th largest in the world. So what we do here makes a big difference. And of course, as an eco-socialist Green New Deal, we want to expand public power, the New York Power Authority, one of the biggest public power authorities in the country, so it can, and right now it hasn't been able to do this, is create more generation from solar and wind in particular, as well as wave and tidal power, which is will make a smaller contribution. We need public banks to help finance all this new green infrastructure, as well as provide climate loans so people can get heat pumps and get their buildings retrofitted for efficiency and where it's feasible, solar and small-scale wind applications. A lot of people would like to do that, but they can't afford the upfront costs. With a climate loan, the upfront costs are covered, and then you save money because you're not buying fuel every month because you're getting it from solar, wind, and you're heating and cooling your house with heat pumps instead of gas or heating fuel. And that difference in the fuel prices will enable you to pay back the climate loan over time and save you money as well. So that's a crucial need. If we just provide incentives in the form of subsidies, only the most affluent are going to be able to take advantage of that. So we need a financing program, and that's where public banks will come in. Now, excuse me, a huge issue, particularly in upstate in New York, is poverty. The latest Census Bureau data shows that upstate New York cities are in the top 10 poverty cities in the nation. And my city of Syracuse is the worst. Child poverty. Syracuse is has the most. 48.4% of our children are in poverty. Rochester's second, right behind us, 48.2%. Buffalo is sixth at 42.3%. These are cities with over 100,000 people. And I have to tell you, you look around the poor neighborhoods in my city of Syracuse, and it looks like some of these Ukrainian cities have been bombed out with all these abandoned houses and empty lots. And in some cases, these houses are just crumbling down to the ground like they were bombed. Second indicator of poverty is family poverty. That's families with kids. And again, Syracuse is first in the nation. 41.3% of our families with kids are in poverty. Rochester's third, 39.8%. Buffalo's sixth, 36%. And another measure is family income. And that means less than $25,000 in income and benefits. So that includes, you know, various forms of public assistance. And the upstate cities ranked a little higher. I think that's because we were able to get the minimum wage raised coming out of my 2014 campaign for governor when I got 5% and Governor Cuomo had to, you know, make some concessions and compete for the in order to compete for the people who are voting for us. So our upstate minimum wage is now $13.20. It's less than the $15 down in the New York City metro area. Upstate got the short end again. But by family income of less than $25,000 in income and benefits, Rochester's fourth in the nation, 29.6, Syracuse seventh, 27.4%, and Buffalo is ninth, 26.9%. So our upstate cities, by any measure of poverty, are among the 10 poorest cities in the country. And we just had a state budget, has no anti-poverty program. It won't be an issue unless the Greens are in the race. So, of course, we're calling for a guaranteed minimum income built into the progressive income tax structure so that if your income is below the poverty line, you will get checks every month to bring you above the poverty line. We want to end poverty, not administer it, which is what our welfare system does now. And so that's, I think, a key issue. I mean, we got a New York health plan legislation, which has been passed in the state assembly since the early 90s. And until the Democrats finally got the majority on the Senate side as well. And now it hasn't come out of committee. That's why we need a Green Party. The Democrats said we'll get single payer when we get the majority in both chambers. And when they did, they stopped even getting it out of committee. So they haven't had a vote in the legislature. And that's why we need the Green Party. Universal public child care, worker co-ops, affordable housing. We need a good cause eviction law, rent control, and we need to expand, not privatize, public housing. And so that means we need a state social housing program to build more public housing until everybody has access to an affordable unit. Got big issues on police reform. We want to end qualified immunity and defend the bail reform that we got last year, which has been whittled down in the state budget. And then, of course, progressive tax reform. We have a stock transfer tax that brings in about $15 billion a year, which is immediately rebated to the people on Wall Street. We need more progressive personal and corporate income taxes, a progressive wealth tax, a more progressive estate tax, and a progressive carbon tax with a refund per capita, which will make it progressive because more affluent people have a bigger carbon footprint. And that's our alternative to what's in the state budget, which was elimination of the gas tax to relieve some of the high costs of filling people's cars. But, you know, a lot of us don't have cars. In this neighborhood I'm in Syracuse, a low-income neighborhood, half the people don't have a car. So that's not going to benefit them. The carbon tax and refund would. And then, of course, inclusive democracy. You know, we've got a democracy crisis in this country. The Republicans in 19 states have passed laws to restrict voter access to the ballot and to put the Republicans in charge of election administration so they can steal elections. And of course, the feckless Democrats have not been able to lift the filibuster at the federal level in order to get voting rights and election protection bills passed to preempt what the Republicans are doing in the states. So, you know, this is something the Greens have got to take up and take the lead on. And we want not just to enable voters to get to the ballot, but we want candidates to get access to the ballot. So that means fair ballot access legislation. And then when people vote, they shouldn't be forced to choose the lesser evil because of the spoiler effect. We have an exclusionary voting system based on single member districts, winner take all, which creates that situation where the lesser evil becomes a choice, because especially now with the Republicans, an extremist, anti-democratic, racist party, a lot of centrists and progressive-minded people say, I got to vote for the Democrats, even though I like what the Greens have to say, because we got to stop these Republicans. So that means we're shopping around legislation for ranked choice voting for all statewide offices and proportional representation in the state legislature through ranked choice voting for multi-member districts, which would create proportional representation. So these are programs that won't even be raised if the Greens don't get in this election. So whatever help you can provide, I greatly appreciate it. There is one more link I'd like put in the chat, which is an article called Medicare for All is Not Enough. And this is by people who are longtime advocates of a national health insurance program, Medicare for All. And the point of this article is that the hospitals and other delivery systems have become so corporatized that to have real equal access to medical care, we've got to make those institutions public. We need a national health service, not just national health insurance, which is one of the things that Angela and I campaigned on in the 2020 presidential election. It's good to see that the single payer advocates, and these are the leading ones who wrote this article, are coming around to that point of view. So, wow, I went on for almost half an hour, but I'm ready for your questions and comments. Frankie Lee, Howie, Putin is forcing EU to exchange euros for rubles to pay for natural gas. Will that keep the ruble stable? The question disappeared. Yeah, I think Russia demanded that, but the Europeans are still paying in euros or dollars. There's a lot of talk about how the dollar is going to lose its status as a reserve currency. And, okay, will that keep the ruble stable so the Russian people won't suffer hardship? I don't think it will by paying in rubles. Paying in dollars and euros is good enough so that Russia has the revenues it needs for basically its military. The Russian government doesn't take care of the Russian people. It's an extreme neoliberal capitalist country. They've gutted all the social services, and there's more inequality in Russia than there is in a country like the United States. So that's not going to pay for the people of Russia. Now, of course, the damage to the economy that these sanctions do is going to hurt the Russian people. And that's why when I was talking earlier about the one demand I didn't agree with from that international statement was demanding reparations from Russia when to rebuild Ukraine when the war is over. Russia is going to need, it needs to be built, not just rebuilt, because, since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the U.S. and other Western countries went in there and pushed a very extreme neoliberal, what did they call it, shock doctrine, conversion to a capitalist economy where they let the former bureaucrats of the Soviet Union plus the crooks, the mafias and the black markets get together and basically take over the assets that the state had owned and become the oligarchs. The people of Russia have suffered enormously. So Russia needs to be built as well as rebuilt. So the other point I was making is I don't think the reserve status of the dollar is not going to be lost anytime soon. It has reduced somewhat because some countries are doing exchanges in other currencies. Russia and China in particular are trying to do that. But it's not going to happen overnight. And, you know, we may end up with two or three reserve currencies at some point, but I think that's down the road. Amy L. Sachs, is there any ethical way to support the right of another country to purchase arms without supporting unethical arms dealers and manufacturers here? Perhaps that's already in the new statement. Yeah, they don't deal with the ethics of the arms dealers. It said you get arms from wherever you can get them. And, you know, the arms manufacturers, you know, their business is to produce arms. And that's unethical. Plus, there's a lot of black market arms exchanges going on. So I think the question here is, you know, what's the greater good or the lesser evil? You know, enabling the Ukrainians to defend themselves or disarming the arms dealers and manufacturers. To disarm the manufacturers and the arms dealers is really going to take agreements between nations. And that's why I think it's so important that when, as this war concludes, we need to push hard for the U.S. and NATO countries, as well as Russia and the other big powers, to get serious about disarmament negotiations, both conventional but also crucially nuclear. The nuclear problem, right now we're in a new nuclear arms race, which the U.S. pretty much initiated under Obama with their nuclear modernization program. Part of that are these hypersonic missiles, which Russia tested out in this war. And that makes the time from launch until delivery of a nuclear weapon just minutes, which puts everybody on edge and even deciding that if they see a missile coming toward them, whether they know it's nuclear or not, they're going to launch their nukes because they're afraid of losing them in a first strike. It's a terrible situation. And, you know, to deal with unethical arms manufacturers, we got to have policies agreed to by nations that disarm and, you know, reduce the need for arms dealers. I would also add that one way to make the arms dealers and manufacturers less influential and perhaps more ethical is to nationalize them, make them public enterprises that don't have a profit motive, but are producing what the government asks them to produce, and that's it, instead of pushing for more. Kevin Sanchez, slightly Machiavellian question, but was Ukraine naive to give up nuclear weapons in 1994? Under the Budapest Memorandum. Well, unfortunately, that's the conclusion that not just Ukraine may draw, but so is every other small nation that fears a big nation's going to intervene. And this lesson has been taught by the United States repeatedly. Iraq gave up its nuclear program, and we invaded and had regime change there. Libya gave up its nuclear program, and we invaded and had regime change there. So Ukraine has said, you know, since Russia violated the Budapest Memorandum, which basically the deal there was Ukraine gives the Soviet nukes that they inherited back to Russia in return for a guarantee from Russia, France, the UK, and the United States, that Ukraine's territorial integrity and independence would be respected. And obviously, since 2014, Russia has not respected that. So, was Ukraine naive? I think they did the right thing. You know, perhaps they should have pushed harder for the countries that agreed to the Budapest Memorandum to uphold it. But there are people in Ukraine that say, yeah, we were naive because now look what happened. We don't have nukes and we're invaded. And that's, you know, a sad lesson to draw. But given the way the U.S. and now Russia are behaving, that's what small countries are going to conclude. And, you know, Iran, Saudi Arabia, are probably the most immediate countries that could go nuclear, but Taiwan, I mean, you name it. We're in a very dangerous situation where nukes could proliferate, and that multiplies the possibilities for a nuclear war, which even if the U.S. is not engaged or the big powers are not engaged, just imagine an Indian-Pakistan war. Excuse me. They both have over 100 nukes. And if they fired them all, we'd have a nuclear winter. We'd have no agricultural produce for a decade, and most of the world would starve to death. And that's aside from the radiation illnesses such a war would create. So I think it is a Machiavellian question, but I think, you know, the conclusion to draw is we got to push hard for serious nuclear disarmament, and the peace movement has got to make that a top priority. Steve Talbot, if I would like for my kids to go to college, but I don't have the money to pay for college, is it ethical to encourage them to join the military in order to take advantage of the GI Bill? Well, again, that's a trade-off. I mean, the risks of going in the military, getting involved in a war where you get killed or maimed or injured, and what that war would be about is one side of the ledger. The other side of the ledger is the benefits you can get by joining the military. I think we should take away that bad choice for kids ready to go to college. And I forgot to mention this is, you know, in New York, we're calling for tuition-free public college. And that's what we should have all across the country. We could do it federally. The federal government could pay for it with, you know, more progressive taxation. We'd have plenty of revenues to do it. And we would also have plenty of revenues to do it if we, you know, cut our military spending, which is just ridiculous. I mean, we're going from, what, 773 this year to 813 next year in the Biden budget proposal. And a lot of that is for nuclear weapons modernization, something like $30 billion. This is insanity when we face a new nuclear arms race. And, you know, these undeclared semi-secret wars the U.S. is engaged in, particularly in the Middle East and Africa, but also, you know, in the Philippines and other places. We do a lot of special operations. This is not the way to build peace in the world. You know, I've often said the U.S. should be the world's humanitarian superpower instead of its military global empire, and make friends instead of enemies. You know, we need a global Green New Deal that helps these countries repair the damages they've already had from climate change and help them make the transition out of 19th century fossil fuels into 21st century solar and wind and other renewable fuels or power. So, let's push for tuition-free public college so these kids don't have to make that bad choice between going in the military in order to go to college. Vicky Corden, maybe NATO should have dealt with Crimea in 2014 and Ukraine joined NATO in order to avoid this war. Your thoughts? If Ukraine was part of NATO, I don't think Russia would have invaded. But for NATO to incorporate Ukraine, I mean, the supply lines, the military infrastructure that would need to be built is enormous. And that, of course, would have made Russia legitimately even more concerned about their own security. I think a better approach would have been to do what Gorbachev proposed, as the Soviet Union fell apart, and that is have a common home for all Europeans with a security architecture that enabled disarmament and mutual inspections of military facilities in order to maintain the peace. And I think that's what we should be pushing for now. Crimea is an interesting situation because even though it was a snap referendum, it's probably true that the majority Russian-speaking population of Crimea did want to get back into Russia, which they had been in before. And the people there are mostly Russians. They're Tartars, who are the indigenous people. Not that many Ukrainians. So Crimea as part of Ukraine was something that happened in 1954, when Khrushchev and his, he was co-ruling the country at that time. I think they had a troika of leaders, changed the administration of Crimea from a Russian district into Ukraine, which was not the long history of Ukraine as a nation. So the status of Crimea, now I wonder, you know, how the Russians felt being under the rule of Russia for the last 8 years. I mean, there's been a lot of reporting on the political repression and the political prisoners and the particularly the indigenous Tatar people have, a lot of them are in Russian prisons just for speaking out against the annexation of Crimea. So, and now that the invasion has happened, it'd be very interesting to see what they would do with a legitimate referendum now. I think Donbass is different. Those are military dictatorships, those so-called people's republics. They have obviously installed leaders. The original leaders were killed, looks like by, you know, Russian FSB. And there's no trade union rights or civil liberties in those so-called people's republics. You know, again, even though it's majority Russian speaking, you wonder what they would decide to do if they had a legitimate referendum. But I think that's one of the things that Ukraine and Russia have to negotiate. And it should really be, because we believe in self-determination, what the people of those areas, Crimea and the Donbass, want. Scout Trooper 164, Howie, what is the possibility of recession? Asking because Breaking Points talked about this. I think it's probably pretty good because of what's happening with the global economy, with the sanctions coming out of this war. And so I think that's just going to undermine the growth that we've been having. And then the inflation is the problem. That's, the bigger problem. So, you know, Marxists have predicted... what's the saying, you know, 12 of the last three recessions, because they're always, you know, looking for crises of capitalism. I haven't studied closely, you know, the idea of a recession. I know the economists are divided on it, but the possibility of recession is always there, given that this is a capitalist economy where we often get overinvestment, overproduction, and then those products can't be bought. So production's cut back, people are laid off, and then they can't even buy what's produced even more so. And that's a chronic condition in the period of capitalism where we're at. So I think, you know, possibility of recession is always there. And we've been stagnant, you know, compared to previous growth periods in capitalism. You know, the last now 14 years since the 2008 Great Recession has been a period of slow growth in global capitalism, except for China, which is now slowing down too. So that's about all I can say about that at this point. Scout Trooper 164, plus, do you believe it's true we'll be overpopulated by 2050? Well, overpopulation is a relative term. You could say we're overpopulated now. The question is, how do we stabilize population? And it's real clear. You end poverty and you liberate women. And then families tend to have fewer children, you know, generally one or two, and population will stabilize. I mean, we're already stretching the limits of the environment, feeding and providing for the people that we do have. And so overpopulation is kind of a relative term. I don't see why 2050 would be a particular deadline. The question is whether population can stabilize by that time, because we have provided for ending poverty and liberating women. And that's really the population question or population related questions we've got to address. Frankie Lee. Are there any state programs for solar and wind power that are close to going national? Well, nothing's close to going national. I talked about that earlier. The Democrats aren't even fighting for any part of Build Back Better now. I mean, the initiative seems to be coming from Manchin, who says, well, okay, we can do a little bit of renewables if we do a lot of pro-fossil fuel programs, which isn't what we need. Now, California and New York are said to be the states with the leading programs. Hawaii is pretty good, but still, they're nowhere near what we need. I mean, California is still fracking. The time frames I'm more familiar with New York is I think they want to get to carbon reductions of 40% by 2040 and 85% by 2050. Or another way is they say 100% net zero. That's the trick with net zero, because that means that other 15% is going to be burning fossil fuels, and somehow we're going to capture that carbon and sequester it somewhere. So the time frame of all the state programs are still too slow. Given what we know from, you know, people like Mark Jacobson at Stanford and the studies he's done with his colleagues, showing that it's technically feasible to get to 100% clean energy in a decade. And that's what we got to keep pushing for. So the state programs, you know, we should push for the best we can get. But, you know, we had a bill passed in New York called the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which was a compromise between the now disgraced Governor Cuomo and the Working Families Party. And it was much weaker than a bill the Greens had gotten introduced called Off Fossil Fuels, 100% Clean Energy by 2030. And so what we got now is a program that is moving slow. The prefatory whereases of that bill said our goal is to get to 450 parts per million carbon in the atmosphere, which was the goal about 2006. Climate science has moved way beyond that. 350 parts per million is what James Hansen, our foremost climate scientist, proposed as a goal. So the bill starts off from the wrong target and then sets up a very long process of planning. So they're now, they call it scoping, and they're now reviewing the scoping plan. It's 4 years later. They haven't done anything. There have been some initiatives by the state. You know, New York is doing some solar and offshore wind in particular, but it's too slow and it's too late. We need to move faster. Gary Bonaparte. Hey, Gary, he's from Syracuse. How you doing? Are Russian dissidents able to seek political asylum in the U.S.? They should as hell be able to. And I don't know. I mean, our asylum process is terrible. The last year, the ceiling was 15,000. They've raised that to 125,000, but we got Ukrainians, I think about 2,000 of them, sitting at the southern border in Mexico trying to get in through the process, which means there are tens of thousands of people there who have been waiting longer than the Ukrainians to get in. Same thing from, you know, disastrous situations they need political asylum from in Central America, Colombia, Venezuela, a lot of Haiti. And so I don't know if it answers a simple yes or no, but it should be a simple yes. And, you know, they're having a real brain drain in Russia. You know, those middle-class educated people are leaving because they realize they can't speak up, and plus the economy is going down the hole, so they have other opportunities. But yeah, we should be providing political asylum for a lot more than 125,000 people. There are something like 25 million refugees in the world and an additional 48 million people who are internally displaced because of wars. And 125,000 is not even a drop in the bucket. And so we should be doing a lot more than we are. Scout Trooper 164, what do you think of Will Smith being banned for a decade from the Oscars due to his assault on Chris Rock? Asking your opinion, since it's been divisive. Is anybody defending Will Smith? I haven't heard it. I'm sure there are some, but you know, I don't know much about the Academy. A 10-year ban is pretty significant, so I guess that's appropriate. I'm actually waiting to see what Chris Rock has to say about it, which will be both funny and serious. Steve Talbot, what is an appropriate way of addressing inequality when engaging people who benefit from it? Well, there's a book called, it'll come to me, I think. Basically documenting how inequality hurts the whole society. It leads to higher crime rates, leads to health problems across the board. It just creates a lower quality society. People are less happy in societies with less inequality. More people are satisfied across the income spectrum that exists in those societies than they do in more unequal societies. So I would just, you know, I guess talking to someone who says, and I've run into them here in Syracuse, I proposed a city income tax, which would include commuters to help fund this broke-ass city. And it was progressive, so if you're under $50,000 in income, you didn't pay anything. 50 to 100,000, you paid 0.5%, and over 100,000, 1%. And I ran into, you know, upper middle class people who said, oh, you want me to pay more taxes? To hell with you. And they are living in a city that has high crime rate, high shooting rate. As I said earlier, you know, some of these neighborhoods look like they've been bombed out. So, you know, my approach to them is it'll make for a better quality of life in the city. Instead of you having to worry about getting mugged. We had the wife of the basketball coach, Jim Boeheim's wife, sitting in a car at the one mall that's in the city. And she was robbed, armed robbery by a 12-year-old. That's what happens when you have a lot of poverty and high inequality. With high inequality, one of the issues is that there's no solidarity between, you know, people in different circumstances. They really see each other as, you know, enemies. And, you know, that doesn't create for a great community. So those are some of the things I would raise with people that, you know, think they're benefiting from inequality and can't afford to have more equality. Steve Talbot, how can society improve education for all if public K through 12 education is funded by property taxes, where more wealthy neighborhoods get more? Well, we can improve education for all if we rely on the property tax. I mean, one of the things we put in our platform, I believe, in the 2020 campaign is federal funding of, you know, public education so that the property tax is not the source of that funding, which is unequally distributed. I mean, that is one of the, you know, big sources of unequal education opportunity. So education should be funded out of progressive taxes like income, wealth, estates, financial transactions, and given where we are with the climate issue, a progressive carbon tax. Emily, we have a mayoral election coming up here in Los Angeles. Why is no one from the Green Party running? Well, is the election, I guess it is this fall, because I know there we do have or did have a comptroller candidate. Well, it's a big job to run for the mayor of Los Angeles. It's a huge city, takes a lot of money. You've got the media monopoly. You know, it's a tough job. And I, you know, that would be my guess that no one in the Green Party felt they could raise the resources and build the organization to run a credible race. The people who are running for office have probably chosen, you know, races lower down that they have a better chance of being credible or even winning. But I think it's good to run in those races to raise the issues. I remember Tom Hayden ran for mayor. He didn't survive. He didn't win. I guess he was, those are nonpartisan races. But one of the demands I remember him having, this is like 20, 25 years ago, is a peace dividend by cutting the police department and putting that money in the social services. Peace conversion, that's what he's talking about. Like we talk about converting the military industrial complex back to civilian production in large degree. He was talking about the same thing with the policing. He was for quote unquote defunding the police before anybody was using that phrase. That's the kind of thing you can do in a campaign like that. Even if you don't have the resources to compete on the media and you know, build a big staff so you can support a real big grassroots campaign, it's still worth raising these issues and, you know, forcing, you know, the Democrats, they may not be on the ballot as Democrats because it's nonpartisan, but the party organization, the Democratic funders, they're all playing in this. By forcing them to compete for votes around issues like that, we move the political debate and can leverage the political system our way, more so than if we're just out there demonstrating for, you know, redirecting, you know, this divest from the police, invest in the community. The Democrats can just ignore that demand unless we're competing for those votes. So I wish there was a Green running for mayor in Los Angeles. Amy L. Sachs, very tricky to discuss overpopulation without fueling the agendas of eugenicists and white supremacists. You're right, it is, because they're the ones that are crying overpopulation. And then when they talk about, well, what are they going to do about it? It gets very draconian in terms of, you know, basically letting people starve to reduce population. That's very misanthropic approach of some of these people. I think of Garrett Hardin, who was considered an environmentalist back in the early 70s. He wrote a book, an article that was very influential called The Tragedy of the Commons. And it turns out he was a white supremacist eugenicist. So yeah, it's a tricky issue. That's why I say, rather than, you know, talk about overpopulation directly, we need to talk about ending poverty and women's liberation, which includes full reproductive freedom, including abortion. So we work on those issues and we'll deal with the problem of overpopulation without fueling the agenda of the white supremacists. Wow, and I just flipped over to the comments. I've been on the private chat with the person helping me do this, and it's already an hour past. So what should I say in conclusion? I think, you know, everything we've been talking about, whether it's the war in Ukraine, the climate crisis, these, you know, economic issues, access to college, poverty, you know, all these issues, you know, until the left has its own independent party, the Green Party is best positioned to be that party, we're going to get nowhere, because we've seen, you know, Democrats got both houses, even though it's close, they got the presidency. We got states like Hawaii, California, and New York, and for a while, Vermont, where the Democrats have both houses of the state legislature and the governorship, and they can't get single payer passed. We can go on and on. And until we're offering an alternative and forcing the whole political system to address us and compete for the votes we're getting, we're going to be stuck and nothing's going to change. So, you know, I really urge people, first of all, to get involved in your local green groups, organize them. Don't be satisfied with just being a, you know, little club of friends. You know, we need mass organizations. So you got to get out there and talk to the people, canvas, run campaigns, incorporate the people attracted to the campaign into the organization, and keep building. And we gotta move fast, because, you know, the crisis of the climate is not waiting. The nuclear crisis is just hanging over us. And as we know, inequality and poverty are life or death issues for those who are in the situation. I mean, part of the, you know, statistics I cited about poverty here in Syracuse, one of the reporters went up to a public school with high poverty, And a lot of these kids don't have anything to eat on the weekends. The school is now trying to give them, you know, care packages to take home. We've got real hunger in a lot of these poor communities. And of course, you know, that's not good for your health, unequal access to the healthcare system. We got an opioid crisis, which is still getting worse. What do we have, 100,000 deaths last year? So the inequality and poverty issue is also a life or death issue. So these are things that are right on us right now. And so, you know, we gotta build and organize. And as I've said before, and I think I'll wrap up on this point, when you're out there fighting for these things and meeting the people and talking to them, you're going to feel a lot better than if you're just sitting home reading the news and feeling bad about it. So, you know, let's get out there and organize and fight for what's right. And we'll see you next week. Power, love.